Today, I am joined by Dr. Aaron Kyle, a professor of the practice in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at Duke University. Professor Kyle is recognized as a remarkable educator and innovator and is shaping the future of engineering education through his unique teaching approaches, emphasizing hands-on, inquiry-based learning and intentional integration of diversity, equity, and inclusion into biomedical engineering design instruction. Beyond the classroom, Professor Kyle is a trailblazer in fostering engineering identity amongst middle and high school students, especially those from underrepresented or disadvantaged backgrounds. As part of these efforts, he co-founded the Outreach Design Education Program, an NIH-funded initiative that has introduced over 1,000 students in New York and North Carolina to the concepts of engineering design. He holds a BS in electrical engineering from Kettering University and a PhD in biomedical engineering from Purdue, which he obtained in 2007. In this interview, I ask him about his journey, his work, and his vision for the future of engineering education. Yeah. So first, thanks very much for joining me. It was awesome to hear your talk this morning, and welcome to Davis.
It's been a pleasure to be at UC Davis. This is a beautiful campus. I love being out in a space like this. I got to walk by the Arboretum earlier.
Nice.
It's beautiful. I wish I had taken more pictures, but I was having a great conversation with Professor George, so I didn't want to be rude, but I loved the scenery here.
It's a nice little loop, a nice thinking loop. Grab a
this
coffee.
This is a make nice a way to kind of, stuff gets a little hectic during the day. You just go outside and walk. You got some cows and horses nearby. Like that's the way to live.
Exactly. So yeah, the focus of your seminar in our department this morning was on the topic of intentional integration of DEI topics into engineering education, probably more focused on biomedical engineering design education. So I think it'd probably be useful to get started with some terminology as you did in your nice lecture. So DEI is in the title of your talk, and of course this is a topic that most people these days are familiar with. But yeah, how are you thinking about these terms, diversity, equity, and inclusion?
So in terms of thinking about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think it is important to be explicit about what these terms mean, because I think they've been ascribe so much of a connotation that it's been lost what they actually mean and how quite beneficent, quite frankly, the terms are. Like, these are good things. Like when you think about diversity, right, recognizing that people are different from each other. When you think about equity, striving to make sure that regardless of where you come from, you can achieve similar outcomes. Who doesn't want that? When you think about inclusion, you consider the fact that, hey, you're looking around and you're seeing people that are maybe from a different place than you are, maybe look different from you are, right? Maybe they make less money. Heck, maybe they root for a different basketball team than you do, but you welcome them into...
I can't accept that.
Well, especially coming from Duke and having North Carolina right on the road. But just those sorts of things, right? I mean, embracing people in terms of their difference. I'm confounded, quite frankly, by how much negative associations have been placed with DEI. And like I said this morning, a little bit of a tangent, I think a little bit of this is kind of a misunderstanding, whether unintentional or intentional, with the diversity side of things. Because I think diversity sounds a little arbitrary, right? It sounds like we just want to bring a bunch of different people in. We're going to fill some quota with different means, a racial minority or whatever folks might ascribe to that. But to me, what diversity means and what's more important than diversity is representation, right? Making sure that what we do is representative of the world around us. It could be representative of the world, our state, our county, our university. But in a sense, right, as engineers, we're supposed to be developing things that are appropriate for people. And those people should be kind of presented or represented in what we do in terms of our technology. So I hope one day actually we end up looking more at REI, representation, equity, and inclusion. But until that day, I will continue to say that the diversity part is not a bad thing, right? Diversity, again, just means people are different. And those differences can go in a lot of different directions. We're all different. All of us have got something that makes us not what we look like on the surface. What's wrong with recognizing it and appreciating it?
Yeah, what about the concept of justice in terms of engineering education and engineering design?
Sure. I think the context of justice is the thing most applicable to what we do as engineers. Because as engineers, oftentimes we are iterating and improving and rebuilding certain things. So within the justice space, we are afforded a lot of opportunities to take a look at something that might have gone wrong, for whatever reason it might have gone wrong. And this is our chance to address those concerns, right? So that's where we can have the most tangible impact, is in the justice space.
Yeah. So what are some examples, you know, some devices or designs where they just have not been designed for diversity or equity or anything like that?
Yeah. The device that gets the most attention, I think, these days is the pulse oximeter, right? So for those that are not familiar, pulse oximeter is an optical interrogation device. It's basically shining red and infrared light, or at least different wavelengths of light, through skin. And you're using kind of the either transmittance or the reflectance of that light for the purposes of, in the simplest sense, quantifying heart rate. That's photoplethysmography. But in a more complicated sense, if you're looking at the ratios of light transmittance and absorbance, you're able to quantify oxygenation levels. And because you're transmitting this light through skin, your transmission is going to be affected by the optical properties of the skin. If we are looking at different levels of melanin in skin, it has been shown that that can have an effect on how light is transmitted and subsequently the quantification of oxygen levels. So if you think a little farther afield, right, if you've got this thing that is inaccurate and its inaccuracy is informed by your skin coloring, that can manifest in you not getting correct oxygenation levels from a person based on something that is completely out of their control. In fact, this was a lot of what was happening during the COVID pandemic, is that people were coming in and they were receiving, or they were under oxygenated in terms of therapies, right? They weren't receiving supplemental oxygen in ICU circumstances, because there were circumstances where their pulse oxes were saying, you know, you were probably okay. Maybe you don't need this to be taken care of. So that's a substantial deficit, right? You've got this device that is failing in this regard, because of the fact that a person's skin color might throw off its performance. It's an opportunity for justice, right? Physical properties that are well understood, and this other factor that maybe has not been considered so much in the operation of these devices.
That one is always particularly troublesome, since it's so fundamental to just establishing patient status in almost any medical context when they enter, you know.
Yeah. I've heard different kind of some clinicians, different folks that will say, yeah, that's kind of a start, but we don't place too much weight on it. But again, we all remember how much of an emergency circumstance the pandemic was, and a lot of assessment of that was oxygenation levels. And they probably couldn't do blood gases on everybody that was coming in, right? So they needed something that was going to be accurate right then and there. And if we had a bunch of these devices that weren't accurate, in addition to all the other things that black and brown folks were dealing with in the mix of the pandemic, you've got a device that is maybe not allowing for proper triage of patients.
And they're increasingly being used at home, right? They're over the counter.
They are being used at home. I mean, people, I have a couple in my own home. We've certainly had them in care of relatives and things like that. So it's a common device, and it's something that is important, or not just important, but also something that probably can be readily addressed, right? And that's what I talk about when I refer to justice and an engineer's opportunity, because we can see something like that, and it's a tractable problem, right? You can make an argument that a lot of this stuff in DEI trends more towards the social spaces, but this is an engineering project. It's an optics project, which your expertise is in, you know better than I, but that's the sort of thing that we can really wrap our arms around.
Yeah, very doable.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about the sort of role of industry and incentive to sort of solve these problems. In your talk, you mentioned about, you know, the example of seatbelt design having some inequities towards females that are often at higher risk of getting injured. As an example of a case where, you know, a very simple design is not acting equally across different stakeholder populations. And I could see that in maybe the case of pulse oximetry, of course, there's a tangible benefit, probably a monetary benefit in terms of healthcare, where you can, or at least expanding a patient population, where there's some implicit benefit that someone will gain from inventing a better technology with a more expanded market, or even an underrepresented or underserved population that didn't have this technology before, right? But what is sort of the role in your mind of regulatory bodies to maybe implement some of these aspects of DEI into product design for biomedical devices, where there may not be an obvious bottom line incentive?
I do think that's the that's maybe the toughest part of this process chain is getting the industry buy-in, right? Because these are efforts that are largely motivated by market opportunities. And if you are looking at something that maybe serves a small segment of the market, it'd be a tough thing to argue here, right? You can't tell Medtronic or Philips that they're going to change up everything just based on being able to address this smaller market share, especially if it comes at the detriment of a larger share. I am of the mind that that opportunity to have things that would be commercializable and would have some market potential comes kind of earlier in the process. And it comes about, like I discussed this morning, when you are finding these problems and focusing on a specific group. And I approach that from the standpoint that what you do for this smaller group, I think will be readily applicable to the larger group. If I develop an accurate pulse oximetry system that will work for people regardless of skin tone, I mean regardless of skin tone, so it will serve darker skin folks as well as it will serve fairer folks, and that combined market opportunity will provide enough value proposition that this is something worth pursuing. Versus looking at it the other way, where if you are developing some technology and you find that maybe there's a small segment that is not well served from, but the broader segment is still served, yes, you might still have the broader market opportunity, but you're excluding a particular group there, or you are ignoring a certain group. So I would hope that starting with a smaller group and focused on that group, that there will come a point where it is applicable to a larger group. And so far, and again, I don't work as much with things that get clinically or commercially translated, but so far I've yet to have a project where the thing that we ended up with at the end of it, if we were focused on something that was DEI related, would not be applicable to a broader population.
Which can be thought about probably as kind of a design constraint. Ideally, you would want something that expands access and not, it has to be changed and tailored to an underserved population, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, speaking to one of the points you made about the regulatory side of things, it's heartening to see that at least on the regulatory side, there's more interest in this, right? We just saw last week the FDA is putting out a call, or they're interested in kind of more diverse groups or more diverse testing, testing groups involved in looking at pulse oximetry devices and things like that. I recall during the pandemic, right, there were calls for more minorities to be involved in the clinical trials. I myself signed up to be one of the vaccine trial participants. I was surprised I didn't get picked, but that's the sort of thing that at least there's a better appreciation for it in the scientific and regulatory communities.
It's heartening that we're starting to be aware of this and make these changes, but it's still a huge challenge that has societal problems or barriers to even start to address those, right?
Well, that's why the resistance to these things is so frustrating, right? Because I think we are, at least were, heading in the right direction just by people being more cognizant of these issues and we being more appreciative of it. I mean, that's better than nothing, but now there's an increased resistance to it. And my biggest hope is that this does not have such a chilling effect that people don't pursue it. And we end up with, you know, when my son is in graduate school one day, that he's talking about these same deficits. At the very least, I would hope that we've examined these things. And if we come to the conclusion that they don't make that big of a difference, fine. But at least have that be informed by the investigation, right? If you find that in looking at different biomarkers that there's not a difference across these different groups, that's great. Just so long as we know it, right? Just so long as we're not kind of doing this based on the fact that, well, we've never done it before and we're not going to do it now.
I find it exciting as someone that is a scientist and is always looking for angles and new, you know, exciting things about the research, that these considerations add another fun level of complexity to consider and to solve on top of the sort of simple problem we were already trying to look for, a biomarker, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was talking to your colleague, Professor Gilchrist, earlier, and that's exactly what he said, right? Is that having these frames, right, with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and justice included, can stimulate innovation, right? That we have looked at things a certain way before, but we didn't look at them in this way. So there's still an opportunity here, right? I talk about the pulse ox. It's a very established technology. We can build that up in an instrumentation class in an afternoon. But if we start thinking about kind of what happens if skin tone changes, what happens if there's more adipose tissue there, right? These are things that are applicable to real world situations that we have an opportunity to expand upon, and we have an opportunity to re-innovate. So yes, as a scientist, and especially as engineers, I think most of us see this as opportunity to do better, And once again, I'd rather get caught trying, right? I'd rather have somebody come along one day and say, "Hey, we did all this data analysis and like didn't make a difference." Okay, that's fine. I can live with it. I'm not comfortable with, we don't know, we've never done it this way before, but we don't want to either. And just sticking our heads in the sand.
And you showed some headlines on your slides this morning of a lot of educational stakeholders caught in controversy over the application of DEI, even just the usage of the terms, right? Period, right? What's sort of your view on our role in maybe combating that? And then maybe you could speak on the hesitancy of some faculty that maybe historically haven't been, you know, focused on this type of research, maybe don't want to wade into that water for fear of, you know, whatever repercussions.
I mean, I think the way to combat it is with empirical support. Again, that's what I keep coming back to.
Data.
Yeah, we're engineers, we're scientists, we deal in data. Like, that's part of why I want to do research on these sorts of things, to find out. I have this hypothesis that it will make for better teams, that it will make for better projects, and whatever that metric for better is. Trust me, I'm not some great scientist, but I'm a good enough scientist not to let things bias me, right? I'm not saying that I know this is going to work out well. I don't. If I do these studies over the next couple of years and I find this didn't make a difference, okay, I can deal with that. But that's my big thing, right? I think it will. I think we're going to find that it does make for better project outcomes. And with that, I would hope to be able to kind of contradict these arguments with data, with support, right? To complement the notion of, hey, part of this feels like the right thing to do, but we have shown as engineering educators and as people that do research with this sort of thing that it works out. I'm not looking to get in anybody's culture battle, far from it. I'm more looking to be a better educator, to be a better engineer. And I think this can be part of being better educators and engineers. With regards to hesitancy, I can't speak to other faculty. I can only speak to my own. And it's part of what I talked about earlier. I mean, again, not wanting to bias a classroom, right? Not wanting to introduce prejudices and make someone uncomfortable, especially not knowing where everyone is coming from. Not wanting to over-constrain problems. Maybe not being knowledgeable about everything that can come up, right? I can speak about experiences being a Black man because that's who I am, but I can't speak to... I've had a lot of deficits in class with like women's projects, for example, right? I can't speak to that as well. So I try to learn about it and do things this way. So I would assume that it's not born out of any malice that somebody might not want to do it. And it's not born out of laziness. It might just be discomfort, right? A lot of us won't do things that we are uncomfortable with. And the stakes on this sort of thing are high. The potential of, you know, making a student uncomfortable, which is very, very bad, is maybe more than the benefits or the perceived benefits here.
So when did you first get interested in science or, you know, science education?
I became interested in scientists when I was a pretty young kid. I mean, I loved the old Transformers TV show, and I was fascinated by this concept of living robots and kind of how would something like this exist. And I just thought that was super cool. And beyond just watching the show and seeing the fighting, that was always the question in my mind. It's like, how would this happen? Like, who created these things, and how could they keep functioning like this? So that was as young as the first and second grade. And then as I got a bit older and started to learn more about different things, I mean, I was decent in math and decent in my science courses, but in middle school, we started to do more biology and started learning more about, I just love learning about the cardiovascular system. And then I learned that there was an electrical aspect of the cardiovascular system in terms of the heart's electrophysiology. And I was just like, whoa, this is
That's
the coolest.
Transformers.
Yeah. I was like, just like, this is the coolest thing. And I mean, from then, I don't even think I knew what it was, but even in like the seventh or eighth grade, I want to be a biomedical engineer. Like, I want to design these devices that apply electricity to the body and all this stuff. And I thought I was going to be some engineer for Medtronic or something like that. So that kind of, I do a lot of research on engineering identity. And I recognize looking back that I was very fortunate to form an identity really early and just kind of stumbled upon some things that were interesting to me. And that persisted, right? I think a lot of times you can come across something like, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. But for me, it came pretty early. And while there were some thoughts in other directions here and there, it was always kind of located around there. Like, there was a little bit of time where I wanted to be a medical doctor, and but it's always been like something related to engineering and science and life and things like that. And that just kind of carried me through. With regards to being an educator, that came quite a bit later. I mean, I joke with people all the time. Part of the reason I went to Purdue University for graduate school is that I thought I didn't have to teach. Like I mentioned to you earlier, I'm an introvert, and the notion of like being around students like that and potentially leading a lecture was terrifying to me, even though I had done a lot of public speaking up to that point in my life. So I was like, oh, this can be great. I'm going to do my PhD studies, do my research, and not have to teach any classes. But yeah, I was wrong about that. I was wrong about that. So I did get an opportunity to TA a class. It was a pretty conventional TA ship, running a lab, grading papers, things like that. That was fun, but it was, again, conventional. It wasn't like it shifted my mindset at all. But I was recruited by a professor at Purdue. Her name is Ann Rundell. She has since passed away, but she recruited me to help develop an instrumentation course. So they were developing their undergraduate course, or their undergraduate program, excuse me, while I was a graduate student there. And I got to work with Professor Rundell on the creation of this course in order to put together something that would be useful for the undergraduate students during their progression to a bachelor's degree. And it was just fascinating to me. I mean, for one thing, I saw pretty quickly the parallels between the sort of research I was being trained to do in terms of like biomedical engineering, and I was doing biomedical acoustics and things like this, and kind of how you could apply research ideas to the creation of a course from kind of its inception through its assessment and iteration and things like that. And I got to be a part of those things as a graduate student. And then I got to be in the class when it was first offered. I was one of the senior TAs for the course, which was probably nice because I got all the fun stuff. Like I got to lead a class here or there. I got to hold recitations and things like that, but I didn't have to grade anything. I was just the supplemental instructor, basically. So all the good, none of the stress. And I just love that as well. So from that point, it was like, all right, this is, I wasn't like doing anything groundbreaking in my research, but I think I was a pretty good educator. Like I was doing okay with the classroom, and I really enjoyed it. And from that point onward, I kind of steered my career towards being education focused.
So where did you grow up, and how did that sort of environment shape sort of these choices that you were making, or, you know, your family structure? Were they driving you towards science or whatever, it kind of hands off? Or
yeah, I mean, my family is not a family of scientists or engineers or things like that. I've grown up in a couple of places. I'm mostly from Omaha, Nebraska. My father was in the Air Force, so we lived in
me
the
too.
Hey, yeah. There you go. So I was telling Professor George earlier, his family is from Nebraska, so he doesn't meet too many people from Nebraska.
Yeah.
And I don't meet too many people with their fathers in the Air Force either. But yeah, my dad was in the Air Force. So we were mostly in Nebraska, but we were stationed in the Netherlands for a few years, which was very cool because even though I was a kid, it was nice to be around a bunch of different folks. And I still have some memories of being over there, but grew up mostly in Nebraska. And was just a nerdy, goofy kid, kind of liked my cartoons, liked my science, liked my video games, liked basketball. And my parents left me pretty much my own devices and to find kind of what I was passionate about. It was never like, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to get these grades. It was more just like, all right, you're doing well, we'll support you. And that it just kind of went on from there. I think I kind of found my own path here and learned more about what was going on. And again, I was pretty lucky. Like I think a lot of people can get these notions of what they want to do, and then when they actually see it, it's like, no, I don't want to do that after all. For me, it wasn't just momentum. It was the fact that I wanted to do it, and the things that I thought I wanted to do did end up being what I wanted to do. Like when I got to college and really started doing electrical engineering, it's like, well, this is tough, but this is pretty cool. Like this is not quite what I thought it was, but it's still quite cool. And then when I got to graduate school, like I said, I didn't think I really wanted to teach. And then I did. And I was like, ah, this is very cool. And this is really what I want to do. So it was that sort of thing. And again, like I was saying before we got on the call, I'm extremely grateful to my parents because they really put structures in place to engender support for my brothers and me. It really made it possible for us to do a lot of different things, for me to do things as unconventional as going to graduate school, which is not everyone's path. So that's, I was very fortunate in that regard.
So after graduate school, by this point, I'm sure you have an idea that you want to become a professional educator or go for one of these positions at a research, a major research or teaching university. Yeah, maybe you can just share a little bit of your experience about what that transition was like and what you were thinking and how you were prepping or, strategizing, if at all, or not just flying by the seat of your pants.
I was flying by the seat of my pants a little bit. I mean, I didn't really know exactly what I was doing after graduate school. My PhD was, we were trying to do an acoustic guidance system for indwelling catheters, but it kind of decomposed into a modeling of acoustic propagation in tubes where the impedance of the fluid was comparable to that of the tube because it just wasn't a well understood space. But I had still really not done much biological. My research was mostly acoustical and signal processing and acquisition systems. So I still wanted to get that biology flavoring. So I did a postdoc at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis, which was an adult stem cell lab, where I got to do kind of a combination of kind of learning more about cell culture, the different sorts of assays involved with kind of, in this case, stem cell growth. And in the lab was focused on angiogenesis. And then I was doing some studies with electromagnetic fields and angiogenesis and neovascularization. And so It wasn't the most fruitful postdoc, but it certainly gave me a diverse set of skills coming out of training primarily as an electrical engineer, as an undergrad and a graduate student. So as I was kind of in the second year of my postdoc, that's when more jobs started opening up that were at the university level that were teaching focused. When I was finishing up undergrad, maybe I didn't look hard enough, but I didn't see anything like that out there. So I was kind of at a crossroads when I was finishing up my postdoc where I was saying, all right, I'm either going to find a university job that is teaching focus or I'm going to go try to teach at a high school or something, like try to teach a science course or something along those lines. I got very fortunate. A teaching job came up at Columbia University. I applied for it. They liked me. They liked what I did. They hired me on. Had a fantastic start to my career, middle to my career, end of my career at Columbia University teaching there. And then recently moved to Duke University in the past couple of years here.
Yeah, what were the sort of motivations to do that, or opportunity driven, or
it was a combination of factors. I mean, I think like a lot of people after the pandemic was kind of thinking about how I was spending my time, where I wanted to raise my family, just being curious about living something different, being in one place for a long time,
and probably the military brat in you.
Maybe there might be a little bit of wanderlust there. I don't know, but that's a lot of other people to be involved in my kind of yearnings to go elsewhere. But I like I said, nothing. It's not like anything bad happened at Columbia. I love those folks there. It's a great university. I went to Duke and I enjoyed meeting the people there. I liked the facilities a lot, and I was curious about how my research might translate in a different space. I've always made this argument that the sort of stuff I do research-wise could work outside of a very urban area. And so far we seem to be proving that
now
pretty well.
Now you have the data to prove
yeah,
it.
Yeah, now it's not just me saying it, but I can actually show that it's working. I thought it'd be a good place to rear my son. It seemed like a good time for my family to try something different.
What would people be surprised to know that you do outside of science and science education?
I don't know if they'd be so surprised because I do present quite nerdy, but I have never lost my taste for animated features in video games. Like I thought I was going to grow out of these things someday. Now my skills have declined a lot. I'm nowhere near as good as I used to be on video games. I don't know if my hands are getting old or arthritic or what's going on, but I play my son at things sometimes and it's just pathetic. But I still go to like video game websites and I read reviews of games and watch them on YouTube. When something comes out, it's not the same excitement as when I was a kid, but I still really like playing games and I like the stories that come with them. And like I said, I thought I was going to grow out of liking animated stuff. No, I pretty much like things. It has to be a certain quality. Like my son watches certain things like, oh, I don't like this. But there are things that I check out and I was like, this is cool. Like I'm going to sit down and just go through all of this. And like, I'm almost 45 years old. It's still like,
I still feel like we're in a golden age now of a lot of video games. Maybe they just
look and say, hey, these folks grew up with it, and we're not going to let them go. Like, we're going
to
cater.
Or those kids like us in that age growing up to become artists are now saying, yeah, I'm going to work on that stuff. Or maybe it wasn't.
I think I did read that was part of it. Like, I really have enjoyed the last couple of God of War games. And that's part of the argument they've been saying is like, yeah, we started this and we were all like in our 20s and now we're in our 40s and we've got kids and that's what Kratos is doing now. So
yeah, right.
It's like, okay, it makes sense that it's a little bit of a softer edge, but yeah, I don't know if people would be surprised by that, but like I will put the occasional Attack on Titan character or video game character into my lecture slides. And I can see the kids and the those that know, they know, and I see them kind of laughing. They're just like, yeah, that's right. There's one of my people.
That's cool. So, I usually like to end these with maybe a recommendation for our listeners or maybe just me. But, what's the last greatest thing that you read or watched?
The last greatest thing that I read or watched. Blue Eye Samurai is pretty cool, but it's not exactly the most profound thing to
the last recommend. Great thing, maybe not the greatest. But yeah.
In terms of what I've read here. I've really been enjoying, there's this writer, S.A. Crosby, and it's not so much that it's not like the most profound literature, but it's Black Southern noir, and his book that he came out with last year, All the Sinners Bleed, that was like a classic mystery, kind of horror, like serial killer stuff. I love horror. I've been reading that stuff since I was a little kid, so anything that's got that is probably going to get me, but it's just kind of the quality of the writing really grips me, and it really got me, and it's just like a page turner. I was one of these people that I kind of succumbed to reading too much on my iPad, so it was nice to kind of pick up a physical book again and like go through it and see that sort of thing.
Definitely get a more sense of progression and
yeah, and I've gotten I've started reading, my mom got me an anthology of Octavia Butler, who's sci-fi writer, one of the first Black women to be in a sci-fi writing. And that really kind of grabbed me a lot. And I enjoyed reading some of her stories quite a bit. Those are the two things reading wise that have stood out with me a lot. I'm ashamed that I don't have the same attention span as I used to, because I was the kid that used to be able to sit down. I think one summer I read some like 20 books. I read thousands of pages one summer, and that was not because I was just sitting around reading, but when I was reading, I was really going through things. And now it just takes a while to get through one. It's like, okay, now I'm going to go to the New York Times, and now I'm going to go to this instead of just sitting down and reading the book that I'm actually reading. So I'm very glad when I just sit down, focus, and get through something. Honestly, this is the first time where I will start something, and if it doesn't hold me, I won't finish it. Like, it used to be anything I picked up, I would go through it. But now it's just like, life's too short.
There's too much good stuff out
there's
there.
Too much out there. It's too short. But yeah, those S.A. Crosby is really, really
okay.
Good.
You turn around to something new. I'll check it out.
It's really cool writing.
So where can people find you if they might want to connect further?
In terms of finding me, I don't do a lot of social media stuff, but I am pretty active on LinkedIn. That's where I kind of post my thoughts on things. It's just linkedin.com. I think it's Aaron-Kyle. My program, Outreach Design Education, we focus a lot on providing design opportunities for middle through high school kids, particularly underrepresented kids and first-gen kids and things like that, hopefully showing that this sort of education and this practice will help engender STEM identity and persistence in these folks. So for those that are interested, awesome. It's sites.duke.edu/ode@duke.
Cool. I'll put it in the description.
All right. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.